welcome. I thought I'll just quickly give an introduction and then we can start talking with Danny, who's our guest tonight. Thought we could start like just thinking about where we are, because that's kind of how I locate myself often. I think a lot of people, I don't know, so we think about where we are to start with. We're in Oxford, and I think that's like a really prominent thing generally when we're in Oxford. In fact, we're in Oxford all the time, and the topic of our talk is Oxford. So that's the first kind of point of location. The other point of location is sort of the geography department, which is quite interesting, because I didn't want it to be in a lecture theatre, but calling up every single other department, or not department, location, colleges, town halls, all the various different locations, venues, everything was charging way too much money, which was kind of, I thought was sort of a weird, ironic thing, seeing as so many students wanted to come and talk about social inequality, that it was costing money. So that's why we're in the geography department. We were shown in by people from the Oxford Hub, which is helping to put on this event, or we are putting on this event. And the Hub is a group based at Oxford, on Tell Street, and we basically try to engage students in social and environmental action during their time at university. And finally, we're in the Halford McKinder Lecture Theatre, which is very relevant because Danny is the Halford McKinder lecturer. And Danny Dorling is a social geographer lecturing at Oxford, who's written lots about social inequality, educational health, economic inequality, and he's part of the research cluster here about transformations in the economy, society, and place. He's taught at Leeds, Newcastle, and Bristol in social geography, and he's the recent author of the book Inequality and the 1%, which may come up this evening as well as very many other books, which... I don't know if they'll come up this evening, but I'm sure they're all quite relevant. I haven't read them, so I'm not... I've only read one of them. So maybe there'll be some more informed questions about other publications of Danny's from the audience. Is that a sufficient introduction? I missed anything very important?
No, that's all you need.
Okay, good.
Thank you. Okay.
So yeah, do you want to start just talking a little bit about social inequality in Oxford?
Yeah, I'll try and talk for just 5 minutes and then we'll have a very quick discussion and then we'll try and get you lot to ask questions about what bothers you most. It's interesting you mentioned Halford McKinder. His picture, I think, is just outside, might be outside the wrong side of the door. He was very interested in access and education. He was the first, I think, lecturer here. He was interested in the Workers' Educational Association and so on, and he created University of Reading. But he was interested in the WEA in Reading because he wanted more people to go to university, but not to go to this university, which was special. Only for certain young men should go to this university. And that was part of what drove him to try to create other ones. And this kind of argument about social class and inequality in Oxford has been going for a very long time. I've bought a report, if anybody is fascinated by it, looking at the statistics from the 1930s about who got into this university and who didn't. It contains wonderful tables on the number of imbeciles from the top schools who were being allowed in at the time, and the demand that this be changed. 12%, and they used the word imbecile, it was... We're much more polite now. 12% came from state schools back then in the 30s. Intake became more equal over time and then maybe becoming less equal now. Essentially, Oxford University tends to reflect English society. If the society becomes more equitable, the education system becomes more equitable in schools, you end up with a more of a mix of undergraduates. If the divisions between people grow, you see more of a division now. And it's also painful to talk about it. I think you may be here not because I said I wanted to discuss social inequality in Oxford, but because of the words disappointing, awkward, or a little embarrassing. There are wonderful class words. The worst thing you can be told by your tutor is that they're disappointed in you. If you didn't grow up understanding the importance of the word disappointed, part of what Oxford will do, we'll teach you that this is the worst possible slur. So class is all around us. I have to say, the reason I have to say class is Again, it's the same fitting in thing. At the age you are now, I did the opposite to you. I grew up in this city, but I went as far away as I could in England. I went to Newcastle, and then I learned many, many things, but above all else, I learned how to say Newcastle and how to say class. And that's never left me after 10 years there. Some statistics for you, if you don't know the kind of debates. I mean, we could be talking about discussing social inequalities in the city, but we're not. We're talking about the university. We could talk about what kind of jobs and roles people go on to do. Late last year, the New Statesman said that, speaking of Oxbridge, and often Cambridge and Oxford are put together, graduates snaffling the largest number of top jobs, while Oxbridge comprise only 1% of the population, their graduates make up 75% of senior judges, 59% of cabinet ministers, 47% of newspaper columnists, and 12% of the Sunday Times Rich List. Now, 12% is not very good, because if you think about it, it's only 12 times. So maybe we're doing something good. We're kind of getting you away from the idea of making money and being a bit more sleeble. If you look at the Sutton Trust on these things, they find, again, High Court judges most likely to come from a particular set of backgrounds. You could be cruel and say, need to be least skilled. Vice Chancellors come from the most diverse set of backgrounds. It's very hard to become a Vice Chancellor. Harder. Not as hard as it is to get into the rich list. Just a couple more for you. The kind of debate about what's happening here and in Cambridge was that private school pupils are 55 times more likely to get into Oxford or Cambridge than state school pupils on free school meals. 55 times being huge. In the report I've got on my desk from the 1930s, they complained that Cambridge was a little bit more progressive than Oxford. And it's exactly the same today. It may be the science bias of Cambridge makes it a little bit more progressive than Oxford, but the problem is then for Oxford, if you're part of the pair of universities which appears to take the lowest proportions of children on free school meals, which essentially you only get free school meals if you're poor, and Oxford out of the two is the worst, it means you are the lowest. The reaction to the university of this kind of revelation in 2010? Not to recognise free school meals as a valid indicator of poverty. It's not a very subtle reaction. Now, the university does an enormous amount. It claims to visit 75% of schools. It agonises about these issues. It has a pool for, we can probably talk about all these things. But this is awkward and embarrassing because of the position we're in. Just one more quote and then I'll shut up. Just four private schools and one highly selective state sixth form college, that one in Cambridge, send more children to Oxbridge than do 2,000 other secondaries. The most prestigious 100 schools secure 30% of all the Oxbridge places, and 84 of those 100 are private. So this is a very odd situation. We have been here before in the 1930s when it was far, far more extreme and corrupt. I mean, there were direct lines of obvious corruption. Things loosened up in the 40s. They loosened up dramatically for women in a few years because the men were fighting a war. It'd be slightly cruel, but... It was a year Margaret Thatcher got in. But I'll say no more about that. We had a whole renaissance of grammar school. Mainly boys, but some girls coming. And it wasn't just that you had state and private schools mixing, but you were getting people from a wide range of state schools. And by the 70s, private schools had a lot less money. The country was dramatically more equal. The rich had less, so school fees were lower. This place was a real mix in the 60s and 70s. I can kind of claim this because I'm a product of it. My mum and dad both went here and met here then. But from the 70s to the 80s and 90s onwards, that began to diminish. State schools in the 1990s began to be ordered into a very, very deliberate order of posh comprehensive to poor comprehensive. In this city, what happened was in the north of the city, there was a secondary modern, which is now the site of Charwell School. If your tutor sends their child to a state school, they will almost certainly send them to Charwell School. It's now the Tatler magazine recommended state school. It was a secondary modern. The grammar school was down in Littlemore. On the site now is the Oxford Academy, which GCSE results were among the lowest 25 secondaries in the entire country. Oxford, just within its state schools, has the widest educational divide in England, and that divide has been created entirely since the 1990s, when it was the other way round. So there was a heady point before then where nobody really knew what a posh or an unposh state school was and so on. Now it's all lined up so that when we look at your backgrounds, and I don't have this data, I look at reports of people who do have the data. Many years ago we were allowed to get the data when people worried less about these things. When we look at your postcodes and your parents' occupations and your school, we will find that those of you who've gone to state schools, which is about 55%, will in the vast majority of cases have gone to the more selective or posher state schools, the areas where the house prices cost more. So there is less mixing from that way. And the last thing I'll say before you quiz me and open up, all kind of odd things happen about the embarrassment of admissions. So one thing that a place like Oxford prides itself in is that 55% of students come from state schools. It's proud because it's over 50. Why does 50% matter? 93% of kids go to state schools. There's nothing special about the 50 below or above. And it's just a way of playing with numbers. Now, the proportion is higher in other universities. I got the shock of my life when I left this city to go to Newcastle and suddenly met an 80% private school cohort, which was extremely educational for me, because I'd only met one child before in my life who'd been to a private school. So other universities have higher proportions. But claiming 55% as an achievement really isn't an achievement. We're reflecting the society we've got, but who gets in is pretty polarised. What they then go on to do is very polarised. If you compare our situation to other European countries, we are extremely odd. There is much more mixing in other European countries. And if you're worried about why bother about going over this now, we're about to get an election. After the election, the entire issue of fees can come up again. And the idea of taking the cap off fees, of charging £16,000 a year to come here after 9 or 25 or whatever, and that has all kinds of implications for who may come and who may not come. So there are reasons to worry about these things, because there are policy decisions to be made which will alter this place again in future. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I suppose like what springs to my mind directly from what you've just been talking about is addressing the fact that clearly there's the problem about why students are coming from state schools has more to do with the society than particularly the university. But then I guess the question that is standing open is how far is it the university's responsibility to address that? And if they're attempting to get something like 55%, how can we actually change the society in such a way? Is it the responsibility of one elite university to do that? Okay. Or how far is it the responsibility of the students in that university?
Yeah. I mean, the university actually achieves 55%. But you might be insulted if you're not from a state school. You know, you can think, why am I not part of a target group? This is pretty nasty. This university does alter society more than anyone else. One of those students who came in the 1930s from a state school was a young man called Harold Wilson, who went on to become Prime Minister at the time of greatest equality. And as I've mentioned earlier, a little bit later, a young lady called Margaret Thatcher came. You know, this university alters society more than any other, just directly through politics, let alone what else it does. And it can fiddle at the margins of things. I mean, one great question is to say, I think our number of overseas undergraduates is only 5%. Might be a little bit higher. It's higher in sub-subjects like engineering and others. But if the policy of the university is about the supposed creme de la creme, surely 95% of the creme de la creme don't just live in England. So why isn't this university undergraduate body absolutely full of people from the rest of the world? And that's a... you can see a kind of decision has been made or a decision has not been made not to alter the intake internationally in the way that other universities have. And these are all policy decisions, all decisions not to make a decision. Yeah. You can't just sit back there and say we're neutral. You're deciding all the time what you do, what edge you put in things, how you push them. I think your power is either to be slightly more progressive than the times or slightly more regressive than the times. So you can either be holding things back a bit or you can be nudging them on a bit. If you're nudging them on a bit, you get a lot of criticism. Bristol University got this in the last 15 years. But also if you appear to be holding them back a bit, you get quite a lot of criticism as well.
Okay, so if we're thinking then about change and about how could this change towards a perhaps more equal educational system, but perhaps also a broader in terms of the city, yeah. How do you think the problem of inequality is predominantly in the way that people think because it's become a social norm, or like the way the psychology people, or do you think it's more structural and thus like kind of harder to change?
It changes. It's changing all the time. The fastest way we would get I could be wrong about things. One way in which we would have a rapid change in this university is if there was a banking meltdown in Europe. A much worse depression or recession than we currently have. Suddenly all the donors would have less money. The people who are actually, you'll see their names on buildings and so on. A lot of the colleges depend a lot on donors to keep going every year. So we'd have to cut our cloth very differently and behave in a very different way. If you look at the buildings around the university, it's interesting that some of the maybe less pretty, more concrete ones were built in those days of the 1960s and 70s that I particularly liked, when the university had less money because the rich had less money to donate. If you look at the latest buildings being built, particularly the maths institute and so on, it's very, very nice. But these things are being built out of the most expensive stone at a time of austerity for the rest of the population, but not for the 1% and the 1% of the 1% of the 1%, who are the kind of people who donate money to allow you to build a building that looks as if it was being built 400 years ago. The other thing just worth saying about this is, if you go back to the 1930s and to when, say, Harold Wilson turned up, that cohort of students were turning up about 5-6 years after the 1929 banking crash, when their elders were telling them, it'll all blow over, don't worry. Free market economics is absolutely fine, you don't need to tinker with it. There's a strange bloke called Keynes saying different things. But in their economics lectures, or the equivalent, whatever they were called in the 30s, they were being told that the basic system worked, and this was a temporary wobble. What the undergraduates discovered is it wasn't a temporary wobble. In fact, they ended up being sent off to fight a war because the generation above them was so incompetent. And that generation of 1930s undergraduates went on to be the ones who brought in a welfare state, who nationalised coal mines, who created the NHS. They went on to be the ones who created comprehensive schools so that for the first time ever, children mixed in the same school. And they did it all in one era. And there's a later era of the people who designed the Big Bang, took away regulations from the bank and so on, and thought this was going to be wonderful. And it takes time to work out if it is. You could be the generation who were like that 1930s generation. It won't repeat itself. But the idea that it's going to be the same, that's very, very unlikely.
Who do you think is going to drive that change?
It's always driven by younger generations eventually. So it's always people in their 30s and 40s eventually squeezing the older ones out of control and out of power. In this country, the change has been delivered largely by the elite over time. It has to be said. If you look at the 1945 government, if you look at the social background of Attlee and so on, look at Beveridge, look at Tawney, all these people were pretty elite. So the elite are likely to have more influence than other people, and that may continue. The one thing to say which is different is that the country is slowly getting poorer, even as it becomes more unequal. So part of what you're sort of experiencing or seeing here is the kind of end days of empire, I think. Whereas if you, I mean, this used to be a chemistry building. The geography building was just down there. When the geography building was down on Mansfield Road, at the height of empire, it was training young men to run the whole of Nigeria, to be in charge of Malaysia. That was the job of the geography department there. We still do a very good job in this geography department today, but the world and the country has changed. So we're not really training people to go out and run entire countries anymore.
Okay. I might ask one last question which kind of moves away from the things we've been talking about at the moment, so that then there's more scope for people to come up with questions. We've been thinking about quite a lot about well-being and sort of community work at the hub. So what kind of effects do you think inequalities, generally now, not necessarily from the university, has on things like well-being and health and...
Yeah.
I mean, perhaps it's obvious, but maybe to highlight those things is quite important.
No, it's not necessarily obvious at all. The there's been a set of surveys done recently by WHO on psychiatric illnesses, of which the most prevalent are to be anxious or depressed, anxiety or depression. And there's an incredibly strong correlation between living in a very unequal country, becoming more unequal, and being likely to be anxious or depressed, partly because it makes sense to be anxious and depressed if that's what's happening, and living in a more equitable country where the rates are much lower. It's different for suicide, which is a very different thing from anxiety and depression, I should say. The scariest thing is looking at the uptake of what are called, Prozac is the short name for what they are. And we've seen an incredible rise of people taking antidepressants in the last few years, but higher in the more unequal countries. So very, very high in the United States, extremely high here in Scotland. I think the latest data, it's more than 1 in 10 people in Glasgow are taking antidepressants every day. The only little country that managed to beat these two for a very short amount of time was Iceland, when it completely tanked, but that's gone. So living in an unequal country where the future is uncertain, where you're being made to compete very much, is scary and frightening and doesn't appear to protect us very much. Although we hide this. You know, to go back to the awkward, embarrassing thing. If you promote a kind of dog-eat-dog competitive culture, you're supposed to say, I'm okay, I'm doing fine in it. In fact, if you survey people in different countries, in the country where people are most likely to be suffering mental illness, they're most likely to answer a selective health question by saying, I'm doing absolutely fine. And in the countries, because you're taught to, how are you today? I'm great. In the countries where the rates of anxiety and mental illness are lowest, which are places like France or Japan or Norway, when people are asked, how are you today? They say, average. Which of course is a much truer answer. You can't be doing great and wonderfully every day. But that is a worry, and we don't recognise it as a worry. 1 in 3 families have somebody with mental illness living with them at one point in time.
Okay. That highlights definitely the effect of inequality on well-being in quite a direct way. I'm going to open it to the floor, so I'm excited to hear your questions. Put your hands up, and I'm going to take questions in twos. Nikki?
Thanks for the talk. I have a question, maybe a bit broad. Do you think there's a link between the fact that most private, or almost all private schools are single sex, and the sort of extent to which we have single-sex schooling compared to maybe other countries like France, for example? Do you think that's contributing a lot to the sort of inequality and perhaps other social factors like emotional growth, and that will lead to sort of different ways of thinking when you get to university and are suddenly exposed to a more mixed yeah. society than you're definitely used to in sort of private school, single sex,
yeah.
even in boarding school. So.
Okay. Test. We did two at once?
Yeah. It's a little bit of a difficult question, but there's sort of three adjectives, the awkward, a disappointing awkward, or just a little embarrassing. Which one of the three is it? And I guess I'm asking that because I think that shapes a lot about how we respond to it. So maybe disappointing is, you know, you'd expect the university to be better, but it doesn't matter. Awkward says something much more fundamental about our society, and that it's much more reflective, and we need to kind of consider that in a much larger way. Or a little embarrassing, almost it's an inevitability. These things yeah. happen, as you said, it just reflects society, doesn't change. I'd love your thoughts on which one it is.
All right. Okay, brilliant questions. I should be, because I'm a nerdy stats person, I should be aware of the proportions of people in single-sex schools in other countries, and I'm not completely aware, but I suspect it's more mixed. This city used to have two single-sex state schools when I was growing up in it, both of which, one closed, the other one merged, so it no longer does. I think it is odd that we segregate still in this way. Some people are in favour of it. I've only been here a year and a half. It is noticeable that some complaints about behaviour in some places, you immediately think those young men hadn't actually been set free before, and they're only set free at the age of 18, and then embarrass themselves. And it's not their fault. It's partly their parents' fault. Nobody chooses the school you go to. But it would be good if I think we did less of that, and it causes a particular mindset. I think about it in a similar way to how many of you may not have ridden the bike much before you came here, because parents are so afraid for their children, they don't allow them to ride bikes when they're young. So you turn up in Oxford, and on the first day of term, in the summer, is absolutely dangerous because you've got all of these people on bikes for the first time. And although it's absolutely brilliant getting international students, many of them are cycling on the right side of the road as well. And in a way, that's how the single, maybe not as strong, but I think that's the worst thing about the city, is the immediate inability. But it may create and sustain certain ways of thinking about women for men. I've never seen people manage to show it makes women more bigoted the other way around. Yeah, disappointing is the, you know, it's terrible to rank lowest on this one, but at least we rank highest on the ref, and we know what really matters, it's the ref, and we're number one. A little embarrassing is, let's have a Social Mobility and Child Poverty Commission and produce a report every year with a baroness in charge of it, and pretend we care about this. And also, more tricky, say that what we want is lots and lots of social mobility, which is finding the few clever cornflakes and bringing them up. Whereas what happens in countries where people are calmer is that they tend to have high rates of social mobility, but the mobility is not from very low to people are much nearer together, so it's much less of an issue whether you go up or down. Because if you're going to have social mobility up, you have to have the same number of people going down. That can work in a country where lower paid jobs are paid far, far more. I think it is extremely awkward, and it is particularly awkward for the better off. And this really isn't well understood to be a very unequal country. For instance, it channels people who are better off now into a tiny number of occupations. You know, if you want to try to ensure that your offspring are going to get, I mean, what is it? Is it A-star AA mainly to get in at the moment? Bit of grade inflation and you're looking at AAA star and A double star? Like how are your kids going to get that? It's going to cost you at current prices £35,000 of boarding fees plus another 15 for the holidays. Put it forward, there's only a tiny number of jobs based around Canary Wharf and Mayfair that you can go for. And so your social horizons, if you want to stay in the 1% and to move into the 1% by income and wealth, your options, your freedom is being narrowed to a very small number of options. Whereas in the 1960s and 70s, students at this university could do a very wide, a much wider range of jobs, and it wouldn't matter that much because the pay was much the same. The 1% in the 1970s only got 4 times average income after tax. Can you imagine that? A top banker getting only four, you know, that's the equivalent of £100,000 a year today, with an average income of £25,000. So you only became a banker if you liked counting money and being meticulous. You didn't become a banker to become rich. And this is what's really awkward. The effects are terrible at people at the bottom of society, but they're also reducing the freedom of people at the top, reducing who you mix with, reducing life experiences, and making people more awkward, because social interactions and environments become awkward. You have to have the most chameleon set of life experiences to have lived with the various different social groups in Britain who are so segregated. Last week, I went to a state school up the London Road called Cheyne. Every day I cycled past a school called Headington High School for Girls. Never went in it. Went in it for the... Well, it's a school for girls, apart from anything else. Went in it for the first time last week to do a lecture. But I just thought, what a strange country this is, when children can go to schools within 100 metres of each other, but there is almost no interaction whatsoever.
More questions? Yeah, go for it.
Talks a lot about how Oxford is perhaps shoddy at getting different mixes of people in. How good is it at levelling the playing field once people are in? Do the inequalities that exist sort of before Oxford still play a determining role after people have been through the Oxford degree?
Okay.
Like in terms of employment prospects, great, salaries, etc.
Yeah.
Okay, can we have one more question? Yes?
That's interesting, but sort of expanding it beyond just inequalities within Oxford University, but Oxford as a whole, apparently it's a city outside of the university, and the effect that you might think that Oxford University has on the city, is that a driver of inequality in the city wider, or is it, the opposite?
Okay, great. On the first one, we don't have exact statistics for Oxford itself, but we do have bigger studies which include the effects of Oxford and Cambridge combined. In general, in most Russell Group universities, state school children do better at university than private school children. Private schools do not equip you well for the average Russell Group university. The ones where there are tutorials and everybody knows your names, private schools do actually, children do just as well. Partly because this is quite a private school environment. But state schools, children do not do, I shouldn't say children, just all the data you're taking where they are at 15 and then looking forward, don't do much worse. There is some evidence about what a shock it can be to come to this place from particular backgrounds, slightly like landing on the moon and having to learn to speak moon language. Collections, formal halls, bedders, I don't know, Porter's Lodge. You know, these are strange things. For universities as a whole, Russell Group University, state school pupils do better, get more first and so on, partly because you're getting a more select group of them who've got through, rather than almost everybody from a private school now goes to university. But afterwards, pupils who've been to private school tend to do better if you measure better by get higher paid jobs. And that's maybe a mixture of have better connections to help you get them, but also may come from a background where it is seen as more important to try to get those jobs and salaries. At wider Oxford, it would be lovely for somebody to do a report that was forced to say, all in all, is it detrimental or is it beneficial? You know, it'd be complicated, but is it detrimental or beneficial? For centuries, there's been hatred between the university and the city. If you've ever wondered why there were these giant stone walls and why there were all these grates and everything around the colleges, they were put up and they were enlarged and they were made stronger when there were fights and when there was murder in the past. There's an amazing history inside Oxford between town and gown. When I was growing up here, there was some violence. People used to sink punts. I don't think there are no punt pilots anymore, are there? No, you haven't. If you sunk a punt, if you jumped off and sunk a punt, you could then pull it out of the river later and claim the deposit and the poor students in it. That's all gone because a lot of working class Oxford has gone, as most of the jobs in the car factory went. However, the university is in many ways one of the lowest paying employers in the city. So because it pays its lowest paid staff, in many cases still the lowest it can get away with, it's sustaining very low incomes around that school which is doing so badly. In theory that should be going, maybe this term. I don't know if a university commitment to the living wage has come out yet, he says carefully. But it's there and on the agenda not to pay anybody less than the living wage in this very, very expensive city. The university also increases inequalities by, for instance, many of the colleges subsidise your tutor's housing. They might own half their house. So the university pushes house prices up in the city. Highly annoying for people who don't work in the university that happens. On the other hand, the university is helping the universities, I should say, because Brooks is expanding faster, is helping make this possibly the most economically successful city in the UK. Because although most of the car jobs have gone, the Mini plant is still producing 1% of our manufacturing GDP, where there's another car industry to the north, there's publishing industry, some of the most successful hospitals in the country, and that's a boom industry, because the oldies are getting older and not dying. And unemployment in Oxford is, I think, less than 1,000 people. Partly because if you do lose your job, you can't afford to stay here. But you know, this is an economically very, very successful city, but one in which most people are struggling to survive in because they're spending so much of their income on rent or mortgage because it is so expensive. And 40,000 people a day are driving to the edge of the city to get park and rides. And there were people living in Birmingham who clean this room later on. And the university and the colleges in particular, and some colleges especially, are the ones who own so much of the dry land around the edge within 4 miles of Carfax that you could cycle in from if you wanted to make this city a little bit more livable.
Yes, in terms of increasing state school intake, would you suggest maybe a quota or something? And if so, well, I speak as someone who went to the state school within the top five of Oxbridge, and sort of, I almost feel like I don't count in terms of, you know, it's quite difficult to compare the sort of preparation for Oxford that I had as to sort of an inner city comprehensive, and sort of how do you judge that?
Okay.
Okay, is there one more question?
Yes.
Do you think there's anything we can do or should do about the particular effect of inequality that pushes people towards the extreme right?
Two very different questions. Okay, the first one. I personally wouldn't go for quotas. I think they are too crude. Although it's interesting to compare the dramatic differences between colleges. There are clearly different ethoses and traditions between colleges that need to be looked at. Just as important as a social class and school background is to question why there are so many male undergraduates here. Given how well young women do at A-levels compared to young men, Cambridge is worse and more sciencey. It's one thing we beat Cambridge in, actually. Or you could even argue on the male-female one, generally men do worse at going to university, but Oxford is helping to turn that around by letting more men in. My big worry about the intake and schooling is that about 28% of the children in this city go to private schools. And at any time in their life, it may be as high as 40%. And if you think who's more likely to be sending their children to private schools, it's more likely to be the university admissions officers, of which there are hundreds. So you have people interviewing you about coming to university, and they, odds on, you know, it's just me deducting it, but given the schools of Oxford and where the staff live, odds on your admissions officers are much more likely to be sending their own children to a private school than the state school. And probably doing so at some sacrifice to themselves, because you know what housing costs in the city are, and we know what academic salaries are. So you're asking these admissions officers to think about how a child from a state school might find it harder to be prepared for an interview when they're shelving out money so often for their own children to go to a private school. So part of the long-term way of making Oxford's intake a little bit more balanced would be to help the schools of this city cope better so that more academics send their children to the state schools. I mean, there's a really easy way to do that, which if they just did send their children to state schools, the state schools would be much better. But it's a kind of game of chicken. You know, it's you first, to do it. But that's part of why society really matters. It's hard to ask university to step out and being a martyr, because you're asking people to do things that would directly disadvantage their own children. So that needs looking at as well. But just compare the different colleges and ask why some colleges are so different from some others is one thing. And that, there are other ways of doing this. One way across the university would be to have to reserve a small pool of places for children who do exceptionally well but don't realise they're going to do well till after their A-levels. That's opening up across the whole country. There are going to be many places that people can take after they find out their A-level results, and that would make more sense. The other thing which is happening this year, which will have an impact on this university, but I can't for the life of me predict what it is that the free fall begins this year. Any university in England can take any number of students it wants this September intake and get £9,000 for each one of them. Now, this university, of course, is sticking to its... We've always had 4 undergraduates in this. We've got 4 bedrooms. We were going to do exactly what we did the year before. Which is, to be honest, very, very nice to be in a place that does that. Because if you're in another university, well, either... Because there's a fixed number of 18-year-olds, you're either going to get far fewer of them, which means that some of you are going to lose your jobs in direct proportion to the students who don't turn up, or twice as many could turn up, and you've got to teach them and explain to them why the lecture theatre won't fit them all and why they've got to sit down the sides, and so on. And that's brand new. It's happening this year. It could be altered by an incoming government. It's unlikely to be the first priority of an incoming government to alter it. And it could easily have the effects of children from state schools getting very, very good A-levels, being more likely to be bribed by Oxford's competitors that it doesn't realise it's a competitor with, because they're trying to get in some students with straight A's into places like Birmingham or Bristol. And we could suddenly discover that we're losing ones that we expected to get. Because we behave the same way that we behave the year after year after year, and are not taking into account that the rest of the system is changing. Did I miss?
Yeah, sorry, I asked a question about the extreme right.
The extreme right, yes, completely different. The extreme right's on the rise in Germany. Those people marching against Muslims have now been joined by some politicians, I've learned for the first time in the first few days. You also don't recognise the extreme right when you have it. So our politics has moved to the right. And the best way to illustrate this is that the Conservative Party is no longer allied with European Conservative parties. It's allied with a group who are to the right of them. UKIP is actually allied to a group who are to the far, far right of that. So we have a much more right-wing politics in some way than other parts of Europe, and UKIP is our far-right option. When times are tough, people tend to go to one extreme or to the other. Down here in this part of the country, the Times the Tough thing has been delayed. There's an economic boom in London. 12 jobs created in London for every one job created in the north. But this may be, you can't, it's very hard to predict the future. But it does really matter for you, because if London does have an economic crash at some point in the future, the first thing you do is not hire people. So it's worth keeping an eye on it. And when people are frightened, they'll do all kinds of things. And they'll start blaming the people coming. One thing which is remarkable is what UKIP don't talk about. So this is a migrant city. 23% of people in Oxford are born abroad. Of those who are not born abroad, those who are born in the UK, almost everybody's a migrant. There's hardly anybody who's three generations Oxford. This is an entirely migrant city. Does UKIP turn around and say, look at Oxford, what a terrible place. Look what the immigrants have done to Oxford. No. Yeah, so it's... But do we turn around and say, look at our wonderful migrant city and celebrate it? Isn't it one of the most cosmopolitan cities in the whole of Europe? No, we're a bit quiet about it. We don't celebrate this. In the same way as we don't celebrate the amazing mix that is now London, the real Big Apple. I'm kind of embarrassed about it.
Perhaps leading on from that, I would have one more question, but I want other people also to ask questions. It would be about, like, why, if we don't celebrate these things, why we don't celebrate inequality, but perhaps we do accept it to a large degree. Perhaps you could address why you think that British people, perhaps, especially, accept such inequality, which is different in other countries.
Okay.
But two more questions. Oh, so many questions.
I'll try and do really fast answers now.
Okay, two more questions. Yes? Yes, you.
What do you think about the role for selective schools and would abolishing them try and help address them?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes?
If you were forced to be non-political or just set aside what you do in the political sphere as an individual in this room, what would you do if you were sitting where I'm sitting and you really wanted to reduce inequality in Oxford?
Okay, to your class. It's amazing to look at different countries' attitudes to inequality. It is often celebrated in the States as being a good thing. We are... My favourite quote in the States is a mayor in Texas who said they can't have pavements because pavements are the slow road to socialism because they're collective. And you can find so many quotes in the States that are like this. But the scary thing is that often what English people say can sound just as ridiculous to far more equitable Europeans. So we don't do that. What would I do about... I'm a bit of a hippie over these things. I don't want to abolish anything. I think we don't notice that we only really have two kinds of schools in this country. We've got state schools, or sometimes church-supported state schools, and we have charity schools. All the private schools are charity schools. We have no for-profit, profit-making private schools. And I have a big worry that if you went down taking away the tax benefits of private, basically, charity schools, you'd actually get real for-profit schools. In the States, they have real for-profit universities that spend more money on marketing than teaching. Because, you lot are fairly clever, but in general, 18, 19 and 20-year-olds, you can tell them they're getting brilliant lectures. How do they know? Especially if you employ marketeers to tell their parents how wonderful it is. And that's the danger of real for-profit private education. It can be truly, truly awful. For reducing inequality in this city, we have to get the living wage paid because the city is so incredibly expensive, and we have to get the cost of housing down. And getting the cost of housing down, I think, means asking, why is Oxford so small compared to Birmingham, London and Reading? And is it the rose-tinted memories of cabinet ministers remembering back when they were 18, 19 and 20 and how exciting it was to be free? And do all the rest they did, and they don't want their Oxford changed But I think we just need some more housing in this particular city. The only reason Britain needs to build more housing is when it gets more people. There's immigration, and we're lucky we're getting immigration, but we're not catering for it.
Okay, it's almost 8 o'clock. Let's do one more question, two more questions. Two more questions, but quick, because it's almost eight. Right at the back.
I was just quite interested in what you said about Cambridge being more equal in a sense than Oxford, and being more of a science-based university. I'd like to hear your thoughts about sort of the inequalities in sciences and humanities students, and how it differs in the types of sort of jobs they have.
Yeah.
Okay, one more?
Last one.
Yeah.
Okay. And I was going to say, what about other axes of inequality? We recently talked about gender, but also race and disability. How do they play in?
Okay, very good. Last question. I'll do the easier one. There are big differences by subject. Have we got any chemists in the room? Well done. Most egalitarian subject. You basically don't do chemistry unless you can do chemistry. It is hard to do that. I'll say it because it's true, although I don't really. The least egalitarian subject, I haven't checked the data for this university, but having checked it for four, is geography. Geography tends to take from a more elite background, hence why our future king actually swapped from fine art to geography at St Andrews. But also theology and other. So your mix of subjects really does alter what you get. You tend to get more nerdy scientists from state schools, or getting food from state schools. The other kind of differences, all these different kinds of inequality matters, but they're going in different directions. And they're sometimes orders of magnitude different. So when you worry about boys and girls differences, okay, girls may be 50% more likely to go to universities from poor areas than boys, but it's only a 50% difference. Between rich and poor people, you're talking 20-fold, 30-fold differences. We can find differences between summer-born children and winter-born children. And parents agonise about this, without their children, and, you know, poor Johnny, you know, he was born in this year. Because, of course, they control their social class they're in, or they can't alter that, but they sort of feel they can alter the other one. Inequalities by race and ethnicity are really interesting in Britain because in many ways, statistically, they've been getting much better. And to put it very crudely, every single migrant group turns out to be a winner. And there was a theory 20 years ago that there were some winner groups, like Jewish people tended to do better, and loser groups like Irish people weren't doing so well. Afro-Caribbean boys weren't doing so well. All that's been blown out. Every single migrant group is and has done better. So there are now more children from ethnic minorities in private schools than there are in state schools. And that's a stunning thing. Even more stunning, I just read the other day, huge increase in kids getting 5 GCSEs on free school meals. In 10 years, it went from just 18% to 38% of all children who get free school meals get 5 GCSEs, A star to C. Afro-Caribbean boys now, 41% of them on free school meals do this. Afro-Caribbean poor boys doing better than the average. Just, you know. So that's a good news story. Racism, racial attacks and prejudice is also rising at the same time. And to end on a depressing one for you, disability is absolutely awful story. Absolutely very bad for success. Quite a lot of effort to change legislation to bring in people to help you if you've got a disability and you're at university. But the people who are being hit first and strongest by the cuts are the disabled. And I saw a list just 2 hours ago, which was 3 pages of 10-point type, which was a list of all the suicides that have been in the last 3 years of people who've had disability payments taken away from them. So there's a whole gamut of stories about inequality, from the kind of extreme good news going on, where you'd never expected that to happen, to something completely new, where, you know, we never thought, after all the great disability legislation we had over the last 20 years, that you would see the biggest cuts occurring to people who are disabled, but that is what is actually occurring. And it will carry on occurring. It all only changes when people fight about it to make it better, when they highlight the differences, when they say there is no excuse to explain why this difference exists. And if you put more effort in, for instance, on poorer children's education, you can double the number of kids who do well at school if you care about it. It is not inherent in them that they are not up to it. But if these things aren't highlighted, then they can exist for longer. Thank you for listening to me waffle on for so long. Thank you.